Hi, everybody. I'm Dweezil Zappa, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guide.
This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Oh, well, hey everyone, it's Nate. I hope you're well. Hope you had a nice record store day over the weekend. Got plenty of loot. I saw lots of social media with you guys and more, just grabbing records over at the independent record shops. Looks like everyone had a great time. So glad it all came together. Now today, dear people, we have on the podcast Mr. Dweezil Zappa, son of Frank, of course, and we're talking about a myriad of topics. Frank's record collection, being taught guitar by Steve Vai, his father's attitude towards him going into the music industry. We talk about Dweezil's unreleased track that features Eddie Van Halen, Brian May, Angus and Malcolm Young, and about 40 other guitarists. As well as discussing the upcoming Dweezil Zappa Rockspostrophe Tour, celebrating 50 years of what are some of my favorite albums, Roxy and Elsewhere, Apostrophe, and I'm sure there's going to be a few other notable tunes in there. Tour dates, tickets, and more shenanigans available at dweezilzappa.com. Now, here on the Vinyl Guide podcast, we've had many Zappa alumni on the show. Just Google up Vinyl Guide, Zappa, and you'll get a whole list of them. Dweezil is just one of multiple Zappa siblings we've had on, alongside many musicians that worked with Frank for many years. Now, personally, I've been a lifelong Zappa fanatic, so it's my absolute great honor to help share the music and stories of the Zappa universe here on the show. And hey, if you like our podcast and you wish to hear it commercial-free and in high resolution, simply head over to patreon.com/vinylguide, sign up for one of our extremely convenient plans, and hot damn, you'll have access to all our extras, extended episodes, commercial-free episodes, high-resolution audio that's more pleasant to your earholes, and of course, you'll have my eternal gratefulness. That's worth something, isn't it? All right, so head over to patreon.com/vinylguide, sign up, and I hope to see you there. All right, enough of the chit-chat. Let's start running with the Dweezil and talk Zappa, Rockspostrophe, guitar, and more.
Hello.
Oh, good morning, sir.
How are you doing?
I'm all right. Got my coffee here, ready to roll. How are you doing? You need your... need any tea or anything? Any lubricants?
I'm good, but the background is a little bit messy because we're doing some filming and stuff, so I don't know if that's going to be a problem.
Ooh, what kind of filming are you doing?
Getting ready for filming all kinds of stuff for the upcoming tour. We're going to make a behind-the-scenes style documentary of what it takes to make a tour happen from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so...
Yeah, you were touring, obviously, for years and years and years. Now we hit COVID. Any fundamentals change or anything, any major changes in the post-COVID world tour?
Yeah, inflation has made it impossible for most people to tour. I didn't tour for the entire, since 2020 up until now. And it's really, it's crazy how much everything costs. So for about 6 weeks of a tour bus, it's $100,000 to rent a tour bus.
Jesus.
And back in 2020, that would have been maybe $60,000. So it's just insane.
Oh, geez. Okay. So tell me about Rockspostrophe. I saw this announcement. It's a tour, right? And obviously, it's celebrating Roxy and Apostrophe, and I'm sure there's other favorites kind of thrown in there. What brought this on? Why Rockspostrophe?
Well, both of those records are 50 years old this year, and what we're doing is playing selections from both records, but we're also doing some things that haven't been done before with certain kinds of hybrid arrangements. I like to do that occasionally where if there's a rare version of one of my dad's songs that would have been played only a handful of times on a tour, but there's a bootleg of it, we will learn those arrangements sometimes. And sometimes I'll take part of the arrangement and I'll fasten it to the original arrangement from the album, or even multiple different things to create a hybrid arrangement that makes it a version that is inclusive of all the ideas my dad ever had for that song. And so that's a interesting take on some of the material. And there's probably three or four songs where we're doing that, where it will become a version that's never been played before because it's a hybrid of multiple things. And I think at this point in time, because I've toured so much prior to COVID, I did 14 years straight of almost somewhere between 60 to 100 shows a year. So as I was thinking about it, that's over 50,000 hours of performing time on stage. That's not even counting the rehearsal that goes into that. So for the most part, I've stuck very closely to what every single arrangement is from very specific things on records. And I've never made personalized changes. So this tour, I'm actually exploring doing some things that are more of my own preferences to make some of the stuff either more challenging or interesting in different ways. So even though we're playing stuff that's from well-known records, Roxy and Apostrophe, the versions of the things we're playing are not going to be stock or standard from the actual albums.
Got it. Okay. So I got to confess to you early on, I'm very, very much a Zappa nerd.
Nice.
I'm not sure what we're supposed to call ourselves. I know Taylor Swift has the Swifties. Is there a name for the condition that I have?
A lifer.
A lifer. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm a Zappa lifer. And Roxy and Apostrophe and Overnight Sensation, those were my entry points. I've now traversed, you know, most of the catalog, and I tend to call this the golden period, right? And you know, if anyone's looking to explore Zappa, this is generally where I set them off. Is this your sweet spot as well? Is this where you tend to gravitate towards?
It's the music I grew up watching as a child be composed and played the most. So it is my favorite era. Anything 74 to around 1980 is my favorite era of guitar playing and sounds and all the stuff that really was the grooviest stuff, you know, the 70s horn arrangements and all that stuff. But then, you know, if I tell people, yeah, the gateway, Apostrophe really is a great gateway into it because it has all these different layers and textures of instrumentation, but the songs are much more, I would say, they're more commercial in a way, they're more memorable and digestible in a way. So if people can get into it from there and then explore all the way back to Freak Out and go that 10-year span to get back up to Apostrophe, or past Apostrophe into, you know, the next several records in the 70s, that is usually how people get really hooked into it. You know, if they like a certain record and then they go back to the beginning and listen all the way up to where that record is that they like, they see the progression and they see how much variety exists in the music and how there's never a time when it's predictable as to what you're going to get from any of the record.
You had the potential of being a witness to some of this. I mean, you're a 69 baby. Yeah. You know, these albums were made early 70s, so you were a toddler around there. Do you have any memories of your dad making these records?
Yeah, I was always around when there were things happening at the house. If he was doing some kind of editing, you would hear the sound of the tape machine being rocked into place. It would be like, whoop, whoop, that kind of stuff. So those were the sounds of the basement at the house. until the main studio was made when I was probably about 11 or 12, it was finished. But there was always sounds emanating from the basement that were him working on stuff. So the music of these particular records, I would hear because he was working at the house on finishing things. But we were around when they did some of the sessions at Caribou Ranch, which was in Colorado. So there were a few different places where I would see him doing things and be fascinated by the sound, or go to a rehearsal or see a live performance. That kind of stuff, it always seemed a bit like a magic trick to see that he could conduct them and have all these hand signals and whatnot, and the band could pull these things off. That even when I started to know more about what was actually happening, it still was like, wow, this is cool. Nobody's doing anything like this. And it's a thing that is unique to his music all throughout his career, mm-hmm. is that he would try to do something that was specific to the audience that was seeing it that night. He never really just said, okay, here's how we play it. Always going to play it like this every single time. He just didn't do anything that was by the book or rote, you know. It was always about trying to stay inspired and do something different or unique in the moment. And that was true for his guitar playing as well. He wasn't the kind of player that had this stock vocabulary that he would just cycle through and just play. You know, if he had to play 5 solos or 10 solos a night, he didn't repeat himself with using the same licks over and over, which most guitar players will play the same licks in many of the solos they play. So it's quite remarkable that he had the ability to have such an extensive vocabulary, and that he played in a way where he was reacting to the music and spontaneously composing. As it, that's very different than just knowing that what the solo is and you just basically play it the same, maybe change a couple of notes here or there, which is kind of the standard operating procedure for most guitar players, is they've composed a solo they're comfortable with that they know they can get through without making too many mistakes. But my dad liked to be on the tightrope, you know, between the Twin Towers and walking across there every time without having any idea what could happen. Wind blows a little different and suddenly now you're in a new place. And that's kind of really what was exciting to him, was to just be able to spontaneously compose like that.
Now, when I watch videos of your dad playing live, obviously he's like this MC. He's the ringleader. He's talking to the audience through a lot of the show. When it comes to a guitar solo, he seems to really kind of go inside himself. That's what I see. I see a man just really kind of exploring himself. Was that your read on that as well?
It's almost like a trance-like state that he goes into when he's really into it. He has said and described it as he's envisioning shapes, and the actual sound molecules are becoming shapes. And it's interesting because you could probably look on YouTube now and you can see if somebody has like a shaker plate and they tune in to a certain frequency, all the sand on a shaker plate creates these new shapes.
Patterns and stuff.
And so I think he kind of was envisioning things like that, or just looking out and seeing as he's playing these things. So he just really described it as being a sculptor making air sculptures out of stuff. Whatever he was playing, he was envisioning shapes out there. So it's very different than just playing through scales or a couple of licks, you know?
Yeah, I've heard him talk about that as well. Now, being his heir, having that gene pool as well, do you see those sort of shapes? Is that kind of how you approach it as well?
I don't, but I do sometimes get into a bit of a trance if I am really locked in to what I'm doing. And the thing that I try to do to make that happen more frequently is I have a note that I put on my pedal board that is as big as I can make it, that just says, listen. And it's actually much harder to do than you think, because when you're a guitar player, you're used to practicing and you just kind of fall into patterns where what you are doing, it becomes familiar. And then you go, oh, wait, I forgot. I'm not even listening right now. I need to react to the music and I need to do something. And if I hear the drummer play a drum fill, can I play a rhythm that's similar on the guitar? And then can he hear that and play something back? Does the bass player get involved? Does somebody else get involved? And that's what it really boils down to when it's happening at its highest level and the best music is being made. It's that kind of conversation where the individual musicians hear each other well enough and are paying attention and responding so that stuff happens and it feels like there's this musical conversation. If one person is just driving the bus and everybody's hanging on and going for the ride, it can work, but it's not as interesting as if you have pauses and you're reciprocating ideas. And that is a much harder thing to do unless you're really tuned into it and you're touring a lot and you're playing with the same people a lot, because you start to have an idea, this is probably a time when they're going to go in this direction, and you kind of get yourself ready to shift. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens once the tour starts, to see what new things happen, because we do have some new people in the band this time around as well.
Oh, okay. All right. How much is the legacy? How many are new?
So over the past several years, the core has been on drums, Ryan Brown, Kurt Morgan on bass, and Sheila Gonzalez playing keyboards and saxophone. And so that's really been maybe the main core of stuff. And there's been a few people that have satellited in or out around that. In this case, this is going to be a smaller band than I've used before, because my dad went from a 4 or 5 piece all the way up to a 12 or 15 or 18 piece band at times. And this tour, we're going to do a 6 piece band. So two of the new people that are going to be in the band, one guy is going to be singing, playing keyboards, playing guitar and drums. His name is Zach Tabori. So we'll have 2 drum kits on stage and there'll be double drums sometimes. Okay. And because that was happening during the Roxy era stuff. And then there's another guy who plays keyboards and sings. His name is Bobby Victor. He also can play drums. So we might have some, special percussion sections and, you know, swapping of the dual drum kit type of thing. So there's a lot of new elements that could be taking place because of the instrumentation and the songs that we're choosing to play.
That's right. Because, yeah, Roxy did have 2 drummers plus Ruth.
Right.
So, yeah, a lot of percussion. So you're prepared to do some of those.
Some of that stuff. We are not bringing out any kind of marimba or xylophone or any of that stuff. Just don't have enough space. And these days, it's more and more difficult to, as we were talking about before, it's so expensive with touring, but now they're being more particular about the weight that you're allowed to fill a trailer that you tow behind a bus. So it's, you can't bring as much stuff, and it's just crazy.
So you're a young boy, you're watching your father work. Did you realize it was a very unique job that he was doing?
It always just seemed like he was having fun. So the idea of being able to do something that you enjoy later in life was clearly something that was appealing. But it's not very easy to take something like this and make it a sustainable way to earn a living. So at a certain point when you're younger, you don't really focus on worrying about the concerns of the sustainability. You're like, oh, this will be fun. I'm just going to focus on this thing. But it is, as life goes on, you have to be dealing with the realities of the sustainability of stuff. So it is a challenge to do it at all, and certainly do it in a way that's commensurate with the way it was done before.
Sure. But I mean, as a kid, as a 5-year-old dweezil watching your father do this work, did you think, oh, this is kind of what every father does? This is
no, I
typical.
Thought it was, well, you know, every family has their own sense of what's normal. So it was normal because we were used to seeing it, but it was definitely different if I went over to friends' houses and their dads had totally different jobs, you know, whether they're a banker or a lawyer or whatever, it's a different relationship to the world. There was always some creative element or aspect to things in our house that wasn't in other households. There wasn't a big focus on the creative aspect of things or the creative thought process or staying in that ability to be able to conjure that for your own well-being. You know, a lot of creativity and stuff is drilled out of children because of the way schools indoctrinate kids. Especially now, it's horrifying. So,
so at what point do you remember a moment or a song or the moment you were inspired to that you wanted to become a guitarist?
Well, I got a guitar when I was six, and I kind of just made noise on it. I banged around on the strings. I didn't really know what to do with it. I liked the sounds of it. I was interested in the sounds it could make, but I didn't know how to operate the guitar with my hands and to make it make music. It wasn't until I started hearing music other than my dad's music when I was 12 that I got interested in trying to play the guitar. And it wasn't because I didn't like my dad's music. I just always knew my dad's music was sophisticated and complicated. And it didn't seem like that's the thing that you could start out from the ground up and be able to do. So when I heard other things like Van Halen or Randy Rhoads playing with Ozzy Osbourne, it was so guitar centric that I could focus on what was happening with the guitar and I could close my eyes and be like, I can hear these things and I feel like I could find these notes, and I would just sit there for hours and hours trying to pick that stuff out. And it really changed how I learned to play guitar on my own, because I visualized the neck very differently than anybody else that I knew that was playing guitar. When I would explain how I saw the guitar neck, they just didn't even understand where I was coming from. And I think what the way I see it is a very simple version, but it still makes people get very confused when I explain it to them, because I'd separate the guitar as three sets of two strings. And when you look at each set individually, let's say the guitar only had two strings on it, there's a finite amount of places where you can put your fingers. The shapes can be symmetrical or not symmetrical. So once you see what these positions are and you recognize how they operate across the fretboard this way and this way, then you realize, wait a minute, the next set of strings, they all have the same notes, but they're just divided by the octave. So if this note is here on the next octave lower, it's going to be down here on the guitar. So you're going to have a jump from here to here, but it's exactly the same shapes. And so in the third octave is exactly the same shapes too. So you have it divided by octaves in three places. So whatever you play, if you have a shape, it's going to be exactly the same on each set of the two strings. So it makes it so you don't have to remember how to play everything based on multiple locations for single notes. It's like, oh, I only have to know this shape because I'm going to do it three times. You know, it reduces it down to a minimum amount of shapes. But then knowing that divided by the octave, you are able to maneuver. So it sounds complicated, but it's actually the easiest way to find your way around on the guitar.
It's actually much more simplified. So is that a technique? Is that a perspective that your dad shared with you or one of the musicians shared with you?
No, it was just, I came up with it on my own because I just realized when I was learning things that I was looking for shapes and patterns and recognition of, well, wait a minute, is everything completely different on every string? And then I realized it wasn't, and it made it much easier to maneuver because it was just, only a finite amount of shapes.
Now, how much time did your dad or the musicians around your dad spend time with you on guitar?
Well, Steve Vai was in my dad's band when I was 12, and he showed me some things and gave me a notebook filled with a couple of important scales and chord diagrams and stuff. And I just was off and running on my own, playing 8 or 10 or 12 hours a day, every day, because I was just into it. So when I needed to have some questions answered, I could go to Steve or I could go to my dad. But I pretty much was always just listening to records and trying to figure stuff out.
Okay. You were teaching yourself then.
Yeah.
For the most part. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understand reading about your dad, there was quite a skepticism around the music industry. I think that's fair to say.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
With good reason. What was his response when you said you want to go in that direction? Hey there, all you record nerds. I want to tell you about BagsUnlimited.com. BagsUnlimited.com has a huge selection of vinyl record supplies. Whether you collect LPs, 7-inch singles, 78 shellacs, or anything in between, BagsUnlimited.com will sort you out. From polyline sleeves to cardboard record mailers to 7-inch storage boxes and archive quality record sleeves, protect your records of any size and shape at BagsUnlimited.com. Whether you have a small personal record collection or you're running a massive record shop, you can grab a small supply or even buy in bulk at BagsUnlimited.com. And they've got some really incredible, unique stuff. BagsUnlimited.com even has special size sleeves made especially to protect your box sets, storage boxes and sleeves for cassette tapes, protective supplies for reel-to-reel, and yes, even 8-tracks. Just go to BagsUnlimited.com, click on audio supplies, and prepare to be impressed by all the options they have. That's BagsUnlimited.com. Well, hey there, record collectors. There's a new service available that specializes in record cleaning, restoring, sticker removal, and professional grading.
VMGVinyl.com.
VMG Vinyl can help you make the most of your collectible records. From professional cleaning of records and sleeves,
removing old price tags and store stickers,
dry cleaning and rejuvenation of old shrink wrap to make it look like new, even providing you a professional, play-tested, third-party grade with either removable grading or encasing in plastic. You have a wide range of choices at VMGVinyl.com.
Buying a highly collectible record and you want it checked out by an expert?
VMG Vinyl can do that too. Head over there now and see what VMGVinyl.com can do for you and your collection. That's VMGVinyl.com, the one-stop shop for professional third-party grading, cleaning, and record restoration. That's VMGVinyl.com. So correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understand reading about your dad, there was quite a skepticism around the music industry. I think that's fair to say.
Sure, yeah.
With good reason. What was his response when you said you want to go in that direction?
Well, he just basically said, well, be prepared for disappointment, you know, because the ultimate situation you're going to run into is if you want to be excellent at something, there's always going to be people who don't care about that, and something has to be dumbed down or compromised. And that's where the disappointment comes in. And my dad, the stuff that he did, he was only able to do it the way that he did it because he was self-financing everything all the time and he had control over what he wanted it to be. But if you were having to be beholden to some other entity that didn't want to focus on making sure that you were doing these very unique and special things, then you would never be able to go down the path that you would want to go. And then the other set of disappointment is nobody cares if you're super talented or just kind of talented. You know, it's more about what you look like and if the timing is right for the look that you've achieved. And that's how marketing has tended to be. And then, of course, MTV destroyed people's ability to enjoy music for the sake of music. It became a visual medium. And then you had even more people that couldn't play but looked the part. And that's where music got commercialized in a way that took away the musicianship element or even the ability to play at all.
Yeah, you could never have a Steely Dan in the MTV era.
It wasn't an important aspect for people.
So at one point, but before his passing, he's I think sold the publishing to the Zappa
catalog to Rykodisc, and I believe one of the comments there was he wants his family out of the music industry, something to that effect.
Yeah,
as I understand. But that was something you were already going in that direction. You wanted to be a musician, or that was something you were preparing.
I had already been doing it for some time, and I had interests in other things too. I was doing television, and I was starting to do some music for television and getting into some possible film scoring. But eventually, one of the things that became of interest was when my dad passed, I realized that he was almost immediately relegated to the "where is he now" file, and nobody really ever understood anything about what he really stood for in music. Because if all you ever heard was "Don't Eat the Yellow Snow" or "Valley Girl," that's not at all what my dad stood for in his entire career. His music was much more interesting and much more about composition, whether classical or jazz rock explorations or any kind of thing that incorporated multiple styles of music. So the instrumental stuff was, to me, the most exciting and impressive part of everything that he did. And when it came time to think about, well, if there's a way to curate something and educate people along the way in a live concert format, I would choose to play stuff that was not the typical things that people thought they knew. You know, so in the beginning, when I started doing the Zappa Play Zappa thing, I really did not focus on the humor aspect of the music. I really focused on the hardcore compositional elements. And it was only after maybe 8 or 9 years of doing it that we really then allowed for a lot of the humor stuff to come in, because that was a thing that I just felt like it was too easy for somebody, if they hear something that has a sense of humor, they go, "Oh, well, he wasn't a serious musician. He did this goofy stuff." And I just didn't like that dismissal. So I was saying to myself, if I'm going to play this stuff, I'm not going to focus on that. I'm going to focus on the hardest stuff. Let the music speak for itself. Because if somebody wants to try to play that, they have to really spend a lot of time to learn how to play it. And you can't just fake your way through it. This stuff is either you can do it or you can't do it.
Yeah. You got to earn that credibility first. You don't want to go out and be a vaudeville act.
No.
Yeah. Knowing your father's always progressing himself, pushing himself in with his music, in his later years, how did he reflect back on albums like Roxy and Apostrophe?
I think he always loved that era of stuff because it was a great band. Ruth was amazing. George was amazing. He liked the drumming styles of both Ralph and
Chester.
Chester, yeah. So all of that era gave him the ability to write difficult music that could be executed very well, but it also could be funky. And that was the thing that I loved about the 70s era, is that there's so much groovy, funky stuff within it. And to me, it's the most exciting period, especially of his guitar playing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there any music that he looked back on that he'd done in the past with, I won't say regret, but probably wasn't his favorite recordings?
I don't think so. I think he really just made stuff that he liked. And if other people liked it, it was a bonus. But there's records that are kind of funny when you find a fan that gets into a record at a strange point in the timeline. Like, I've met people whose first record they ever heard was Thingfish, and they got into it. And it's like, that record, if you get into that and you like that, you know, that's a real weird place to start anyway. So that's a special person that is, yes, this is the record for me. So it's always fascinating to find out what kind of person likes one of the records that's so polarizing, because that's a record that most people can't even listen to. And there are other records like that for people. But then there's also certain people that only like the first couple records from the 60s, and they don't really follow once it gets into the 70s or 80s. And then there's some people that only like the stuff from the 80s and can't get into the stuff from the 60s or 70s. So it's weird that with the amount of eclectic music and the overall sense that things should have variety, that there are still people that find a way to narrow their focus and don't allow for the whole big picture. For me, I listen to all of it, and I certainly have preferences of areas in the music that I like the most, but I can appreciate all of the things that he did, because it's crazy the amount of variety in the output that he created.
Yeah, I think it'd be very difficult to be a Zappa fan, certainly not a lifer, if your bandwidth was only a handful of records. I mean,
yeah. There's a lot of people that go, "Oh man, I'm your dad's biggest fan. I've got all of his records." I'm like, "Really? How many do you have?" Like, I got like at least 6 or 8. You know, it's like, that's not even, that's nothing, you know?
Your father was pretty avid, I'd almost say near obsessive archivist of his own material, recording every gig and having just tons of tape rolling. You know, tape was rolling all the time, I think it's fair to say. Do you have a similar proclivity towards recording performances or your own?
We do have virtually every show that we've played recorded. I don't know that anybody would ever care, but it's good to have stuff in case something miraculous happens and you really do want to go back and say, "Oh, this is the best version of Inca Roads that I ever played," or this is, you can, it's nice to be able to have access to stuff if you want to turn it into something, but it's certainly not something that I have done because I was thinking, "Oh, this will be this monumental thing for a legacy." Like, I don't care about a legacy. Like my dad, when people said, you know, what do you want people to think about you when you're no longer here? You know, he says, how would you like to be remembered? He says, I wouldn't. So he said, being remembered is for people like Nixon, you know? So you could see the kind of, there's like a self-deprecating sense of humor in there, but by the same token, with him saying that, I also felt like, well, I get why you would say that, but I do think what you did has value and you did things that other people couldn't even compare to. So if I can, I'll do something to celebrate what I think are the greatest achievements. And even if it flies in the face of saying, I wouldn't want to be remembered, I think there are things he should be remembered for. And I have set out to make sure that people could recognize what those things are.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in past years, I know there's been some challenges with the Zappa Family Trust. Is all that in the rearview mirror now?
Well, for the most part, yeah. But, you know, it's not like the family is, oh, great. You know, it's a family again. That's not happening.
Okay. All right. So any involvement in the Roxy by Proxy or the Roxy?
I didn't have anything to do with any of the releases or probably the last one I had something to do with was the one that I did some surround mixing on, which was the one, what was it called?
Quadrophiliac?
Yes.
Ah. So I'm assuming you've heard the Roxy performances.
I've seen the footage from the film and I've heard the record that came out that had the extras. Mm-hmm. And it's cool. There's some cool stuff. I would say that there's also things that have been put out that my dad wouldn't have put out because they wouldn't have passed muster. You know, it wouldn't have been the thing for him to put out a record that would have, let's say, 5 concerts where he's playing essentially the same set list. It was rare for him to do that anyway, but where he would play a show that was predominantly the same night after night, that usually wasn't something that he did. But putting out a record that had 5 different versions of the same thing and have his guitar be out of tune in most of them, he would have bypassed those. He would have been like, nope, not good enough.
Mm-hmm. No one's going to hear this. No one should.
Yeah, okay. We wouldn't have cared to put it out.
Okay. Was there anything in those Roxy recordings that made you look at that concert differently, or your approach even to playing that material now?
It's fun to listen to some of the differences and hear other songs that they were playing that didn't get played a lot on that tour, but he had prepped so that they could be filmed and performed. So, you know, there was hints at things that were from Gregory Peccary and stuff like that, that were being played in different ways. So that stuff's fun and cool. I would, if I had the ability to have a lot of rehearsals and do a very special performance, I'd love to learn the whole Gregory Peccary suite. That would be super crazy. But I don't think we're ever going to have enough time to be able to do that, because it would take probably 5 or 6 months of rehearsal, and there would be no tour that could make back the money that it would cost just to rehearse.
Right. But what material of your father's do you find the top of the mountain, something that you are still aspiring to play?
Well, there's a few things that we haven't played that were kind of on my list of things that I would love to do, because, you know, like I just said, Gregory Peccary would be a great one, but there's also something called Revised Music for Low Budget Orchestra, which kind of the same era and has some themes that are in that Gregory Peccary kind of area. But that piece has this amazing nylon string guitar solo that was then also played by horns and harmonized. So it was transcribed after my dad played it, and then the horn parts were added. And it's just such a cool texture, and I would love to do that one day. But again, I just don't think there would be a way to do it, because it would cost so much money to rehearse it that a tour just wouldn't earn it back.
So, okay, Rockspostrophe Tour, it's starting in August. Is that right?
August 1st, yeah. Okay. So because I'm doing this countdown thing, I think we're at, it's 120 days, either 121 or 120 days now until the first show. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of crazy when you look at it like that, because now everything's in a time warp. I have to really start learning stuff, and I have to build a guitar rig, and I have to do a bunch of other things still to get the tour on its feet. We're going to have different versions of rehearsals where we start in different chunks. Like, we're actually going to start rehearsals next week for do 2 weeks. Then we'll go back to individual time where we all work on our stuff, and then we'll come back to playing as a band closer to like a month before we actually hit the road. So we'll do a get together, and then it'll go back to solo learning. And then by the time we're ready to go into the final set of rehearsals, we'll be able to just run a lot more stuff more quickly, because everybody should know their parts pretty well by then. And that's going to be what the process is.
And the dates you have are largely in the U.S.
They're only in the U.S.
What are any international plans or thoughts?
No, not right now. It's with inflation, it just doesn't make sense.
I tell you what, you and the whole band can stay at my house in Sydney. You're more than welcome to. I hope you don't mind dogs, but
yeah,
yes,
I love dogs. Yeah.
So no. Perhaps that's in the future. We'll have to see.
Yeah, one would hope. Right now,
absolutely, I'll be hoping. Dweez, I want to run past a few things with you that are on your credits. Perhaps stuff that's not as related to your father, if that's all right.
Sure.
Because your history and the different projects you've been involved in are extremely impressive. I'm looking at some of the guest appearances with Extreme, Weird Al Yankovic. The one that stuck out is really quite compelling is the Ozzy version of Staying Alive. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of that recording?
Hey there, I gotta tell you about the Groove Washer. Not because I have to, but because I want to. The Groove Washer is the best record cleaner you can get. And if you have a vinyl collection, you need to keep it clean. Dirt and dust lead to groove wear, which affects the sound and value of your record collection. Use the Groove Washer to clean before each play, and your ears and future pocketbook will thank you. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store, or go direct to groovewasher.com and use promo code VinylGuide10 at checkout. Groove Washer is a great holiday gift. Why not send one to a friend? Groovewasher.com, discount code VinylGuide10. Do it now.
Dweezil, I want to run past a few things with you that are on your credits. Perhaps stuff that's not as related to your father, if that's all right. The one that stuck out is really quite compelling is the Ozzy version of Staying Alive. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of that recording?
So when I was making the record Confessions in 1991, I decided to do a heavy metal cover of Staying Alive because it's one of those songs that for people was in some ways a guilty pleasure. There's nobody that can hear that and not have it really get stuck in their head. There's so many elements of that song that are perfectly crafted to be memorable. But I thought it would be interesting to see what happened if I did a version where it was just a very hard rock or metal version of it. And I thought, who would be the greatest singer to do it? So I found a way to get Ozzy Osbourne to sing it. And we did it. But at the point where the record was going to be released, for some reason, they blocked that version from coming out. So I replaced him on the initial version that came out with Donny Osmond. So I went from the Ozman to an Osmund, you know, and but the Ozzy Osbourne version is a classic. It's great to hear him. He is a very good singer. Ozzy Osbourne, when he doubles his vocals, he is very spot on, and he just, there's such a cool sound to his voice. And I've always loved him and Black Sabbath and his solo records, you know, especially the Randy Rhoads ones. So it was fun. It was great to work with him. And he did know my dad a little bit. I know Tony Iommi from Black Sabbath was also friendly with my dad. So that was a cool, fun thing to do. And, you know, it was a good memory to be in the room, make it happen.
I would have loved to have seen the interaction of someone like Ozzy and your father. Were you witness to any of those exchanges?
They saw each other one or two times at the house. And I think the funny thing is that Ozzy has said his favorite Frank Zappa song is Big Leg Emma. So it's an oddball tune for him to choose. But, you know, there's a big dilemma about my big leg Emma.
Yeah. I could actually see that being in one of the early Sabbath albums, because early Sabbath had that kind of plodding kind of rhythm as well.
You never know. I mean, that one was kind of like almost like 50s rock big band, you know. But anyway, you know, Ozzy has always been somebody that I thought was a really cool musician. And I know my dad had some Black Sabbath records in his actual vinyl collection, because I used to listen to him.
Mm-hmm. Did he have quite a big vinyl collection?
Yeah, it was mostly stuff that was doo-wop records and some oddball classical stuff and folk music from all over the world.
When would he listen to music? Was it a nightly thing, every so often? How did that?
Every so often, if he was not in the studio. And there was a place that was called the Alcove, where all the albums were stacked on this wall in that area, and there was a record player in there and some speakers, and he'd just sit down and listen to some stuff from time to time.
Would he go record shopping? Did it get sent to him? How did he?
Not anymore. Yeah, he did all that stuff growing up, but some records would be sent, like newer records would somehow get sent sometimes. But he didn't really care about new records too much.
Okay. When one of his own albums came out, was that kind of a interesting day for the family? You get a box of dad's latest project?
It didn't really seem to be anything of note at the time growing up. We would definitely hear some of the records after they were released. We would hear them more. I remember there was 8-track cassette versions, and they would be in the car. Like Apostrophe was one that we would listen to constantly on an 8-track in the car, going to school or whatever.
Okay. You mentioned Ozzy, and I know you've got a very in-depth appreciation of Eddie Van Halen, as well as Randy Rhoads. Did you ever have any time with Randy Rhoads? Did you ever see him live?
I never got to. He passed away before the show for the Diary of a Madman tour was supposed to be in LA. It was only like 2 weeks before the show was supposed to take place. So that was a real tragedy, the whole thing there. But there was a lot to learn from Randy's playing. And one of the things that I always took from his playing was that if you listen to what he did in the band that he was in called Quiet Riot versus what he did with Ozzy, in a very short period of time, his playing changed drastically. It was so drastic that you had to wonder if, when he was playing in Quiet Riot, if he had to dumb down his playing to make it fit in that, because he was so technically proficient only months later with the Ozzy stuff. That it really was wild, the transition that he made from one band to the other. And so, as a kid, being able to hear, wait a minute, he went from here to here in such a short period of time, it was something to aspire to and realize that it could be done. And so, that's how I was constantly practicing and trying to reach new levels and never. I still, even now, don't look at what I do as being sort of an expert or a master at anything. I'm always still a student of whatever it is. So even with this tour coming up, there's a couple guitar players who can do some things that I don't know how to do. So I'm going to take a few lessons just to be like, yeah, maybe this technique will be something that I'll incorporate. And so for me, it would be not uncommon at all to keep doing stuff like that, take lessons and learn new things. And even Randy Rhoads would do that on the tour that he was doing. He was taking classical guitar lessons. So that was something that I definitely took in from him, and it's always made sense to stay on that path.
I understand that there is a track that you've been working on for many years.
Yeah.
The title, What the Hell Was I Thinking?
Yep.
That features dozens of guitarists, many of them no longer here with us.
Yeah, there's a few that are not with us anymore. So, yeah, there's a lot of people on it. It's got Edward Van Halen, Eric Johnson, Brian May, Angus and Malcolm Young, Steve Lukather, Brian Setzer, Warren DeMartini, Joe Walsh. I don't even know. There's at least 40 different people. Robin Ford's on there. Jimmy Vaughn's on there. So there's newer players that are popular now that I would like to do some stuff and have them be a part of it. But I was for the longest time also trying to get Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton, because the idea of this piece of music is that it's a continuous piece of music that's morphing all the time. It changes from style to style, and the atmosphere where the music is taking place also changes. So it might go from being like an old time record sound to a live music hall or whatever the new atmosphere it wants to become. And it's also kind of like if you were turning the dial on a radio and just hearing different music change each time. It's a bit like that. But then you have different guitar players that start playing on things. And sometimes it's things that you would never hear them play on. So the juxtaposition of them being heard on something that is outside of their normal domain makes it even more interesting to hear the different players and see what they do. Yngwie Malmsteen's on there. I made him play on a really slow blues So that was fun because he still plays 7 billion notes, but at a really slow tempo, you know, on the track. So he sounds even faster. So it's cool. But I think that thing, now that I'm working in different styles of music technology, like my studio is set up to mix in Atmos. This project is definitely going to be great for Atmos because it's a totally immersive experience. So that's what I'm going to focus on when I have time to really try to wrap it up. But I've been working on that thing since 1990 or even 1989. I can't even remember when I started it. So it's a long time coming, but there's other stuff that I've been doing in Atmos lately. I just, I did it a while back, but it just got released a few days ago, was the Deep Purple box set. I remixed the Machine Head record in stereo and Atmos. So there's a whole new remix of that in stereo that can be heard on all the streaming services and stuff. But then I also did all the songs from the record in Atmos. So that's a fun thing to have been able to work on as well.
So, okay. So you're kind of doing a little bit of the Steven Wilson thing, taking some of the classics and Oh, excellent. Mm-hmm. Any other projects coming up you can talk about that you're looking to remix?
Nothing yet that I can talk about, but there are some fun things afoot. And I love the format. I think it's going to be really interesting when people are actually recording records from the ground up with Atmos in mind, because it's very different if you think about arranging a song with the format in mind, because at the point where that song is brought to life, it will always be within that format versus something that was known to be in stereo and then you start making changes to put it around. Some people get very narrow-minded with that stuff and feel like if you are changing something, it's not going to be for the better. But you always have the option to listen to the version that you like. I feel like when you have an opportunity to hear something in a new way, it's exciting. You know, how many times could you hear your favorite record for the first time again? You know, if it's done well, it's very exciting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I'm really enjoying what is happening with a lot of these remix projects. I know they've gone through the Pink Floyd catalog and the Beatles catalog, and you're starting to hear things that were, you know, that were, I guess, always there, but mixed down a bit. Right. And you're starting to kind of hear them a little bit crisper. The fades are smoother. I enjoy revisiting. It's like revisiting an old friend in new light. Back to what the hell was I thinking? Why is it taking so long? And it sounds like you've got a plan for how we may be hearing it in the not too distant future. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, some of it was problematic because it started on analog tape, but it was on the bigger reels of tape, and the machine that was used, unbeknownst to me, as it got closer to the end of the reel, the tension would make it so that the speed would change slightly. So what would happen is you would have this recording and you couldn't really tell what you did that was recorded all together. Let's say you recorded guitar, bass, and drums. You wouldn't really hear the slight pitch change, but when you tried to do an overdub, it would never stay in tune. So you would have to redo all of the guitar and bass stuff so that it would stay stable. The drums, you wouldn't really hear the change in pitch. But so there became a few things like that where some of the stuff that got recorded, I couldn't add overdubs because it was tracked in a way where it was gradually going sharper and, you know, it was problematic. So it went to a different format. It went to these Sony 48 track machines that were at my dad's studio. And at a certain point, I was moving along on that. And then one day, out of nowhere, on a playback, you just started hearing things and you would watch on the board, like meters, like things just dropped out and like disappeared. And I'm like, okay, so wait a minute, what's happening here? Why are we not hearing that? Just figuring maybe there was like a bad connection at the patch bay, but the machine somehow just decided to like erase tracks. It never was put into record. So there were a bunch of things that it ate. So then I had to go back to the original analog tapes and transfer them to a different digital format. And I had to do different overdubs. So I kept having to keep reworking on parts. And then I would just get busy with other things. And it wasn't until I finally was like, okay, now this has to get into a computer, because this is all pre-Pro Tools and all that kind of stuff. So then it finally got onto a computer. And then when I moved from one place to another with a studio, the drive that all that stuff was on got damaged somehow. And so I've had to go back to the original analog tapes again and transfer them to now a DAW. So there's just like a whole bunch of stuff that I have to keep redoing to build it back to the thing. And it's been just this weird comedy of errors the whole time. But at the same time, it's also giving me a way to conceive the project in a way that I never would have, because I never knew I would be getting into the Atmos stuff and all these things back when I started it. So I'm not worried about it. It'll be what it'll be when it's time to hear it.
God, that's a fucking nightmare. But I guess you're right. It does. It's given you the time to at least get you to this point to where you have the tools to then reimagine it in a... Yeah. In a 360 degree. Okay. So it was a music bed you created in the 90s.
Yeah.
That everyone's been kind of assigned different sections, maybe. Yeah. Edward, here's your...
Most of them came into the studio and I was able to work with them directly to say, hey, let's do this. Like, I went to Metropolis Studios in London when Brian May played on it. Mm-hmm. And he was funny because... the section that he's playing on is in five. He goes, oh no, is this in five? And I said, yeah. He said, oh, I can't play in five. He was nervous that he wouldn't be able to play in five, but he played perfectly fine in five. And then he also would take breaks and he'd say, you know, I only really feel that I play when I'm inspired, either out of joy or sadness. And so he would have some tea and sit for a little while. And I guess wait till he was either sad or filled with joy. But it was interesting to see the process of how people worked. And, you know, some people were super fast, like Joe Walsh. He brought in a tiny little Fender amp and the talk box, and the part that he was playing over, we had it ready to go. And we just recorded the first time as he was playing through, and he just got one solo first take. And then we did another pass of a counterpoint part and he did another thing. So he was there for playing for less than 10 minutes. So,
wow. Tell me about Eddie's part.
So Edward's part was really cool because it was done at 5150 and he used his original amp, you know, the one that's on the first few records. Mm-hmm. And he hadn't used it in a long time. At that point, he was using the 5150 amp that he had designed with Peavy. But we pulled out the old amp and the main solo, he's got two solos, but the main solo is kind of like a greatest hits of all of his best guitar licks. And it was kind of a joke because I said, let's do a thing where you put all these licks that are from your solos, we'll just kind of see if you can find a way to connect them. He's like, well, like which licks? And I would have to show him like, play this lick, you know? And so he was saying, why don't you play it? You sound just like me anyway. So he was joking, but it was this thing where it was almost like if you had a toy Eddie Van Halen, you could be like, I'll make my Eddie Van Halen play this, you know? And it was, that was kind of the fun experiment, and it really was a lot of fun to do. We had a good time doing it. But I had another interesting thing with him where, not related to that, but in 2010, I opened for Jeff Beck in Los Angeles, and he came to the show, and he wanted to see, we were he came to the sound check, and then after the sound check, he was like, "What was that one song that you were playing?" And he was referencing the thing. It was the song St. Alfonso's Pancake Breakfast. He's like, "How did you even learn to play that part?" Because I was playing the marimba part, which was never played on guitar, and it's super crazy. And he's like, "Show me what that is." And I showed it to him. He's like, "I could never play that." So it was a real flip, because I used to go to his shows and talk to him and ask him how to play things and stuff. And it was kind of like, I'll never be able to play that. But, you know, it was a total role reversal at that point. So it was an interesting experience to have.
Mm. So you have all the parts. You just need to spend time mixing it. You have everything, yeah. Everything you need.
Okay. Well, there's still some people I'd like to be able to record, but, you know, see if I can make that happen.
Okay. On this Rockspostrophe tour, can we expect perhaps a few special guests here and there from your dad's history?
I don't know. I've been in touch with Chad Wackerman, so he might sit in with us somewhere. But
four drummers.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe.
Wow. Okay. Well, I really hope that comes overseas. Dweezil, thanks for spending time with us. There's never enough time to talk about all the things that I wanted to cover. But we haven't even talked about your time with Spinal Tap, your recordings with Pat Boone.
Yes.
There's a lot. Sam Kinison. Eddie.
Yeah, I played on a bunch of things. I mean, then there's the Don Johnson record. There's all kinds of things. So
The Vandals. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, look, we'll get you back on, hopefully to promote an Australian tour at some point. I want to make sure people are all aware of Dweezil Zappa's Rockspostrophe tour. You can go to dweezilzappa.com. There are links to be able to get tickets. I also highly recommend checking out the Running with the Dweezil podcast. If you are a Van Halen nerd like I am, like many of us are, and want to hear some really interesting stories of people who've worked with Eddie, not just Dweezil. Dweezil's your story about Eddie and the high school talent show is
crazy.
It is absolutely bananas. But then you have like Lou Saraceno and all sorts of other, Steve Vai telling all sorts of stories about their time with Eddie. Then Running with the Dweezil podcast. You can get that again at dweezilzappa.com. Thank you so much, Dweezil, and Godspeed to you, man. Hope everything comes together on this tour, and we're looking forward to hopefully some international dates in the new year.
Sounds good. Thanks.
There he is. Mr. Dweezil Zappa, ladies and gentlemen. Again, the Rockspostrophe Tour. You can find tickets and tour dates at dweezilzappa.com. I can't recommend that podcast highly enough, Running with the Dweezil. That's the Zappa and Eddie Van Halen worlds colliding. That's actually super special as well. So check that out. And of course, if you want to hear extended version of this episode, as well as commercial free and high resolution audio for Vinyl Guide episodes past and future, head over to patreon.com/vinylguide. Sign up there, and we appreciate the support. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. A big thank you to everyone who's sharing these episodes on social media, putting them on Facebook groups and Reddit forums and sharing them on their Facebook pages and tweeting them out on Twitter or X or whatever they're calling it now. That's hugely appreciated. And, mate, a big thank you goes out to those of you who are leaving positive reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Again, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you so much for helping extend the awareness of this show. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.